to the garden and caught Elaine staring at me.
What?
Elaine shook her head and went back to weeding.
You just look so different. You sound so different, too.
Indeed, I hadn't quite believed my eyes when I'd passed a hall mirror last night. My face was still the same, but there was a glow about me, a kind of shimmering light that was nearly undetectable. I knew without a doubt that it was because of my time in Prithian, that all that magic had somehow rubbed off on me. I dreaded the day it would forever fade.
Did something happen at Aunt Ripley's house? Elaine asked. Did you meet someone?
I shrugged and yanked at a weed nearby.
Just good food and rest.
Days passed. The shadow within me didn't lighten, and even the thought of painting was abhorrent. Instead, I spent most of my time with Elaine in her little garden. I was content to listen to her talk about every bud and bloom, about her plans to start another garden by the greenhouse, perhaps a vegetable garden, if she could learn enough about it over the next few months. She had come alive here, and her joy was infectious. There wasn't a servant or gardener who didn't smile at her, and even the brusque head cook found excuses to bring her plates of cookies and tarts at various points in the day. I marveled at it, actually, that those years of poverty hadn't stripped away that light from Elaine. Perhaps buried it a bit, but she was generous, loving, and kind. A woman I found myself proud to know, to call sister. My father finished counting my jewels and gold. I was an extraordinarily wealthy woman. I invested a small percentage of it in his business, and when I looked at the remaining behemoth sum, I had him draw me up several bags of money and set out. The manor was only 3 miles from our run-down cottage, and the road was familiar. I didn't mind when my hem became coated in mud from the sodden path. I savored hearing the wind in the trees and the sighing of the high grasses. If I drifted far enough into my memories, I could imagine myself walking alongside Tamlin through his woods. I had no reason to believe that I would see him anytime soon, but I went to bed each night praying that I'd awaken to find myself in his manor, or that I'd receive a message summoning me to his side. Even worse than my disappointment that no such thing had happened was the creeping, nagging fear that he was in danger, that Amarantha, whoever she was, would somehow hurt him.
I love you.
I could almost hear the words, almost hear him saying them, could almost see the sunlight glinting in his golden hair and the dazzling green of his eyes. I could almost feel his body pressed against mine, his fingers playing along my skin. I reached a bend in the road that I could have navigated in the dark, and there it was. So small. The cottage had been so small. Elaine's old flower garden was a wild tangle of weeds and blooms, and the ward markings were still etched on the stone threshold. The front door, shattered and broken the last time I'd seen it, had been replaced, but one of the circular window panes had become cracked. The interior was dark, the land undisturbed. I traced the invisible path I'd taken across the tall grass every morning from our front door, over the road, and then across the rolling field, all the way to that line of trees. The forest. My forest. It had seemed so terrifying once, so lethal and hungry and brutal, and now it just seemed plain, ordinary. I gazed again at that sad, dark house, a place that had been a prison. Elaine had said she missed it, and I wondered what she saw when she looked at the cottage. If she beheld not a prison, but a shelter from a world that had possessed so little good, but she tried to find it anyway, even if it had seemed foolish and useless to me. She had looked at that cottage with hope. I had looked at it with nothing but hatred. And I knew which one of us had been stronger. Chapter 30. I had one task left to do before I returned to my father's manor. The villagers who had once sneered at or ignored me instead gaped now, and a few stepped into my path to ask about my aunt, my fortune, on and on. I firmly but politely refused to fall into conversation with them, to give them anything to gossip over. But it still took me so long to reach the poor part of our village that I was fully drained by the time I knocked on the first dilapidated door. The impoverished of our village didn't ask questions when I handed them the little bags of silver and gold. They tried to refuse, some of them not even recognizing me, but I left the money anyway. It was the least I could do. As I walked back to my father's manor, I passed Thomas Mandray and his cronies lurking by the village fountain, chatting about some house that had burned down with its family trapped inside a week before, and whether there was anything to loot from it. He gave me a too long look, his eyes roving freely over my body, with a half smile I'd seen him give to the village girls 100 times before. Why had Nesta changed her mind? I just stared him down and continued along. I was almost out of town when a woman's laugh flitted over the stones, and I turned a corner to come face to face with Isaac Hale, and a pretty, plump young woman who could only be his new wife. They were arm in arm, both smiling, both lit up from within. His smile faltered as he beheld me. Human. He seemed so human with his gangly limbs, his simple handsomeness. But that smile he'd had moments before had transformed him into something more. His wife looked between us, perhaps a bit nervously, as if whatever she felt for him, the love I'd already seen shining, was so new, so unexpected that she was still worried it would vanish. Carefully, Isaac inclined his head to me in greeting. He'd been a boy when I left, and yet this person who now approached me, whatever had blossomed with his wife, whatever was between them, it had made him into a man. Nothing. There was nothing in my chest, my soul for him, beyond a vague sense of gratitude. A few more steps had us passing each other. I smiled broadly at him, at them both, and bowed my head, wishing them well with my entire heart. The ball my father was throwing in my honor was in 2 days, and the house was already a flurry of activity. Such money being thrown away on things we'd never dreamed of having again, even for a moment. I would have begged him not to host it, but Elaine had taken charge of planning and finding me a last-minute dress. And it would only be for an evening. An evening of enduring the people who had shunned us and let us starve for years. The sun was near to setting as I stopped my work for the day, digging out a new square of earth for Elaine's next garden. The gardeners had been slightly horrified that another one of us had taken up the activity, as if we'd soon be doing all their work ourselves and would get rid of them. I reassured them I had no green thumb and just wanted something to do with my day. But I hadn't yet figured out what I would be doing with my week, or my month, or anything after that. If there was indeed a surge in the blight happening over the wall, if that Amarantha woman was sending out creatures to take advantage of it, it was hard not to dwell on that shadow in my heart, the shadow that trailed my every step. I hadn't felt like painting since I'd arrived, and that place inside me where all those colors and shapes and lights had come from had become still and quiet and dull. Soon, I told myself, soon I would purchase some paints and start again. I slid the shovel into the ground and set my foot atop it, resting for a moment.
Perhaps the gardeners had just been horrified by the tunic and pants I'd scrounged up. One of them had even gone running to fetch me one of those big floppy hats that Elaine wore. I wore it for their sake. My skin had already become tan and freckled from the months roaming the spring courtlands. I glanced at my hands, clutching the top of the shovel. Calloused and flecked with scars, arcs of dirt under my nails. They'd surely be horrified when they beheld me splattered with paint. Even if you washed them, there'd be no hiding it, Nesta said behind me, coming over from that tree she liked to sit by. To fit in, you'd have to wear gloves and never take them off. She wore a simple, pale lavender muslin gown, her hair half up and billowing behind her in a sheet of gold brown. Beautiful, imperious, still as one of the high fae. Maybe I don't want to fit in with your social circles, I said, turning back to the shovel. Then why are you bothering to stay here? A sharp, cold question. I plunged the shovel deeper, my arms and back straining as I heaved up a pile of dark soil and grass. It's my home, isn't it? No, it's not, she said flatly. I slammed the shovel back into the earth. I think your home is somewhere very far away. I paused. I left the shovel in the ground and slowly turned to face her. Aunt Ripley's house. There is no Aunt Ripley. Nesta reached into her pocket and tossed something onto the churned up earth. It was a chunk of wood, as if it had been ripped from something. Painted on its smooth surface was a pretty tangle of vines and foxglove. Foxglove painted in the wrong shade of blue. My breath hitched. All this time, all these months. Your beast's little trick didn't work on me, she said with quiet steel. Apparently, an iron will is all it takes to keep a glamour from digging in. So I had to watch as Father and Elaine went from sobbing hysterics into nothing. I had to listen to them talk about how lucky it was for you to be taken to some made-up aunt's house, how some winter wind had shattered our door. And I thought I'd gone mad. But every time I did, I would look at that painted part of the table, then at the claw marks farther down, and I knew it wasn't in my head. I'd never heard of a glamour not working. But Nesta's mind was so entirely her own. She had put up such strong walls of steel and iron and ashwood that even a High Lord's magic couldn't pierce them. Elaine said you went to visit me, though, that you tried. Nesta snorted, her face grave and full of that long simmering anger that she could never master. He stole you away into the night, claiming some nonsense about the treaty. And then everything went on as if it had never happened. It wasn't right. None of it was right. My hands slackened at my sides. You went after me, I said. You went after me to Prithian. I got to the wall. I couldn't find a way through. I raised a shaking hand to my throat. You trekked 2 days there and 2 days back, through the winter woods? She shrugged, looking at the sliver she'd pried from the table. I hired that mercenary from town to bring me a week after you were taken, with the money from your pelt. She was the only one who seemed like she would believe me.
You did that? For me?
Nesta's eyes, my eyes, our mother's eyes, met mine. It wasn't right, she said again. Tamlin had been wrong when we'd discussed whether my father would have ever come after me. He didn't possess the courage, the anger. If anything, he would have hired someone to do it for him. But Nesta had gone with that mercenary.
My hateful, cold sister had been willing to brave Prithian to rescue me.
What happened to Thomas Mandray? I asked, the words strangled. I realized he wouldn't have gone with me to save you from Prithian.
And for her, with that raging, unrelenting heart, it would have been a line in the sand. I looked at my sister, really looked at her, at this woman who couldn't stomach the sycophants who now surrounded her, who had never spent a day in the forest but had gone into wolf territory, who had shrouded the loss of our mother, then our downfall in icy rage and bitterness because the anger had been a lifeline, the cruelty a release. But she had cared. Beneath it, she had cared, and perhaps loved more fiercely than I could comprehend, more deeply and loyally.
Thomas never deserved you anyway, I said softly. My sister didn't smile, but a light shone in her blue-gray eyes.
Tell me everything that happened, she said. An order, not a request.
So I did.
And when I finished my story, Nesta merely stared at me for a long while before asking me to teach her how to paint. Teaching Nesta to paint was about as pleasant as I had expected it to be, but at least it provided an excuse for us to avoid the busier parts of the house, which became more and more chaotic as my ball drew near. Supplies were easy enough to come by, but explaining how I painted, convincing Nesta to express what was in her mind, her heart, at the very least, she repeated my brush strokes with a precise and solid hand. When we emerged from the quiet room we'd commandeered, both of us splattered in paint and smeared with charcoal, the chateau was finishing up its preparations. Colored glass lanterns lined the long drive, and inside, wreaths and garlands of every flower and color decorated every rail, every surface, every archway. Beautiful. Elaine had selected each flower herself and instructed the staff where to put them. Nesta and I slipped up the stairs, but as we reached the landing, my father and Elaine appeared below, arm in arm. Nesta's face tightened. My father murmured his praises to Elaine, who beamed at him and rested her head on his shoulder. And I was happy for them, for the comfort and ease of their lifestyle, for the contentment on both my father's and my sister's faces. Yes, they had their small sorrows, but both of them seemed so relaxed. Nesta walked down the hall, and I followed her. There are days, Nesta said as she paused in front of the door to her room across from mine, when I want to ask him if he remembers the years he almost let us starve to death. You spent every copper I could get, too, I reminded her. I knew you could always get more. And if you couldn't, then I wanted to see if he would ever try to do it himself, instead of carving those bits of wood. If he would actually go out and fight for us. I couldn't take care of us, not the way you did. I hated you for that. But I hated him more. I still do.
Does he know?
He's always known I hate him, even before we became poor. He let Mother die. He had a fleet of ships at his disposal to sail across the world for a cure, or he could have hired men to go into Prithian and beg them for help. But he let her waste away.
He loved her. He grieved for her. I didn't know what the truth was. Perhaps both.
He let her die. You would have gone to the ends of the earth to save your high lord.
My chest hollowed out again, but I merely said, yes, I would have, and slipped inside my room to get ready. Chapter 31.
The ball was a blur of waltzing and preening, of bejeweled aristos, of wine and toasts in my honor. I lingered at Nesta's side,
because she seemed to do a good job of scaring off the two curious suitors who wanted to know more about my fortune. But I tried to smile, if only for Elaine, who flitted about the room, personally greeting each guest and dancing with all their important sons. But I kept thinking about what Nesta had said, about saving Tamlin. I'd known something was wrong. I'd known he was in trouble. Not just with the blight on Prithian, but also that the forces gathering to destroy him were deadly. And yet I'd stopped looking for answers, stopped fighting it. Glad, so selfishly glad to be able to set down that savage, wild part of me that had only survived hour to hour. I'd let him send me home. I hadn't tried harder to piece together the information I'd gathered about the Blight or Amarantha. I hadn't tried to save him. I hadn't even told him I loved him. And Lucien? Lucien had known it, too, and shown it in his bitter words on my last day. His disappointment in me. 2 in the morning, and yet the party was showing no signs of slowing. My father held court with several other merchants and aristo men to whom I had been introduced, but whose names I'd instantly forgotten. Elaine was laughing among a circle of beautiful friends, flushed and brilliant. Nesta had silently left at midnight, and I didn't bother to say goodbye as I finally slipped upstairs. The following afternoon, bleary-eyed and quiet, we all gathered at the lunch table. I thanked my sister and father for the party and dodged my father's inquiries regarding whether any of his friends' sons had caught my eye. The summer heat had arrived, and I propped my chin on a fist as I fanned myself. I'd slept fitfully in the heat last night. It was never too hot or too cold at Tamlin's estate.
"I'm thinking of buying the better land," my father was saying to Elaine, who was the only one of us listening to him. "I've heard a rumor it'll go up for sale soon since none of the family survived, and it would be a good investment property. Perhaps one of you girls might build a house on it when you're ready."
Elaine nodded interestedly, but I blinked. "What happened to the Bedders?"
"Oh, it was awful," Elaine said. "Their house burned down and everyone died. Well, they couldn't find Claire's body, but..."
She looked down at her plate. "It happened in the dead of night. The family, their servants, everyone. The day before you came home to us, actually."
"Claire Bedder," I said slowly.
"Our friend, remember?" Elaine said.
I nodded, feeling Nesta's eyes on me. "No. No, it couldn't be possible. It had to be a coincidence. Had to be a coincidence, because the alternative..." I had given that name to Recent, and he had not forgotten it. My stomach turned over, and I fought against the nausea that roiled within me.
"Feyre?" my father asked.
I put a shaking hand over my eyes, breathing in. What had happened? Not just at the Bedders, but at home, in Prithian.
"Feyre?"
my father said again, and Nesta hissed at him, "Quiet!" I pushed back against the guilt, the disgust and terror. I had to get answers. Had to know if it had been a coincidence or if I might yet be able to save Claire. And if something had happened here in the mortal realm, then the Spring Court, then those creatures Tamlin had been so frightened of, the blight that had infected magic, their lands. Fairies. They had come over the wall and left no trace behind. I lowered my hand and looked at Nesta.
"You must listen very carefully," I said to her, swallowing hard. "Everything I have told you must remain a secret. You do not come looking for me. You do not speak my name again to anyone."
"What are you talking about, Feyre?"
My father gaped at me from the end of the table.
Elaine glanced between us, shifting in her seat. But Nesta held my gaze, unflinching.
I think something very bad might be happening in Prithian, I said softly. I'd never learned what warning signs Tamlin had instilled in their glamours to prod my family to run, but I wasn't going to risk relying solely on them. Not when Claire had been taken, her family murdered, because of me.
Bile burned in my throat. Prithian? My father and Elaine blurted. But Nesta held up a hand to silence them. I went on.
If you won't leave, then hire guards. Hire scouts to watch the wall, the forest, the village too. I rose from my seat. The first sign of danger, the first rumor you hear of the wall being breached or even something being strange, you get on a ship and go. You sail far away, as far south as you can get, to some place the fairies would never desire.
My father and Elaine began blinking, as if clearing some fog from their minds, as if emerging from a deep sleep. But Nesta followed me into the hall, up the stairs.
The bedders, she said. That was meant to be us, but you gave them a fake name, those wicked fairies who threatened your high lord.
I nodded. I could see the plans calculating in her eyes.
Is there going to be an invasion?
I don't know. I don't know what's happening. I was told that there was a kind of sickness that had made their powers weaken or go wild, a blight on the land that had damaged the safety of their borders and could kill people if it struck badly enough. They said it was surging again, on the move. The last I heard, it wasn't near enough to harm our lands.
But if the Spring Court is about to fall, then the blight has to be getting close, and Tamlin
was one of the last bastions keeping the other courts in check, the deadly courts. And I think he's in danger.
I entered my room and began peeling off my gown. My sister helped me, then opened the wardrobe and pulled out a heavy tunic and pants and boots. I slipped into them and was braiding back my hair when she said,
"We don't need you here, Feyre. Do not look back."
I tugged on my boots and went for the hunting knives I'd discreetly acquired while here.
"Father once told you to never come back," Nesta said, "and I'm telling you now, we can take care of ourselves."
Once I might have thought it was an insult, but now I understood. Understood what a gift she was offering me. I sheathed the knives at my side and slung a quiver of arrows across my back, none of them ash, before scooping up my bow.
"They can lie," I said, giving her information I hoped she would never need. "Fairies can lie, and iron doesn't bother them one bit, but ash would? That seems to work.
Take my money and buy a damned grove of it for Elaine to tend." Nesta shook her head, clutching her wrist, the bracelet of iron still there. "What do you think you can even do to help? He's a high lord, you're just a human."
That wasn't an insult either, a question from a coolly calculating mind. "I don't care," I admitted, at the door now, which I flung open. "But I've got to try."
Nesta remained in my room. She would not say goodbye. She hated farewells as much as I did.
But I turned to my sister and said, "There is a better world, Nesta. There is a better world out there waiting for you to find it. And if I ever get the chance, if things are ever better, safer, I will find you again." It was all I could offer her. But Nesta squared her shoulders.
"Don't bother. I don't think I'd be particularly fond of fairies."
I raised a brow.
She went on with a slight shrug. "Try to send word once it's safe. And if it ever is, Father and Elaine can have this place. I think I'd like to see what else is out there. What a woman might do with a fortune and a good name."
No limits, I thought. There were no limits to what Nesta might do, what she might make of herself once she found a place to call her own.
I prayed I would be lucky enough to someday see it.
Elaine, to my surprise, had a horse, a satchel of food, and supplies ready when I hurried down the stairs. My father was nowhere in sight, but Elaine threw her arms around me and, holding tightly, said,
"I remember. I remember all of it now."
I wrapped my arms around her.
"Be on your guard, all of you."
She nodded, tears in her eyes.
"I would have liked to see the continent with you, Feyre."
I smiled at my sister, memorizing her lovely face, and wiped her tears away.
"Maybe someday," I said.
Another promise that I'd be lucky to keep. Elaine was still crying as I spurred my horse and galloped down the drive. I didn't have it in me to say goodbye to my father once more. I rode all day and stopped only when it was too dark for me to see. Due north, that's where I would start and go until I hit the wall. I had to get back, had to see what had happened, had to tell Tamlin everything that was in my heart before it was too late. I rode all of the second day, slept fitfully, and was off before first light. On and on, through the summer forest, lush and dense and humming, until an absolute silence fell. I slowed my horse to a careful walk and scanned the brush and trees ahead for any sign, any ripple. There was nothing. Nothing, and then my horse bucked and shook her head, and it was all I could do to stay in the saddle as she refused to go forward. But still, there was nothing. No marker. Yet, when I dismounted, hardly breathing as I put a hand out, I found that I could not pass. There, cleaving through the forest, was an invisible wall. But the fairies came and went through it, through holes, rumor claimed. So I led my horse down the line, tapping the wall every so often to make sure I hadn't veered away. It took me 2 days, and the night between them was more terrifying than any I'd experienced at the spring court. 2 days before I spied the mossy stones placed across from each other, a faint whorl carved into them both. A gate. This time, when I mounted my horse and steered her between them, she obeyed. Magic stung my nostrils, zapping until my horse bucked again, but we were through. I knew these trees. I rode in silence, an arrow knocked and ready, the threats lurking in the forest far greater than those in the woods I'd just left. Tamlin might be furious. He might command me to turn around and go home. But I would tell him that I was going to help. Tell him that I loved him and would fight for him however I could, even if I had to tie him down to make him listen. I became so intent on contemplating how I might convince him not to start roaring that I didn't immediately notice the quiet. How the birds didn't sing, even as I drew closer to the manor itself. How the hedges of the estate looked in need of a trim. By the time I reached the gates, my mouth had gone dry. The gates were open, but the iron had been bent out of shape, as if mighty hands had wrenched them apart. Every step of the horse's hooves was too loud on the gravel path, and my stomach dropped further when I beheld the wide-open front doors. One of them hung at an angle, ripped off its top hinge. I dismounted, arrow still at the ready. But there was no need. Empty. It was utterly empty here. Like a tomb.
"Tam?"
I called. I bounded up the front steps and into the house. I rushed inside, swearing as I slid on a piece of broken porcelain, the remnants of a vase. Slowly, I turned in the front hall.
It looked as if an army had marched through. Tapestries hung in shreds, the marble banister was fractured, and the chandeliers lay broken on the ground, reduced to mounds of shattered crystal.
Tamlin?
I shouted. Nothing. The windows had all been blown out.
Lucian!
No one answered.
Tam!
My voice echoed through the house, mocking me. Alone in the wreckage of the manor, I sank to my knees. He was gone. Chapter 32. I gave myself a minute, just 1 minute, to kneel in the remnants of the entry hall. Then I eased to my feet, careful not to disturb any of the shattered glass or wood, or blood. There were splatters of it everywhere, along with small puddles and smears down the gouged walls. Another forest, I told myself, another set of tracks. Slowly, I moved across the floor, tracing the information left. It had been a vicious fight, and from the blood patterns, most of the damage to the house had been done during the fight, not afterward. The crushed glass and footprints came and went from the front to the back of the house, as if the whole place had been surrounded. The intruders had needed to force their way in through the front door. They'd just completely shattered the doors to the garden. No bodies, I kept repeating to myself. There were no bodies and not much gore. They had to be alive. Tamlin had to be alive. Because if he were dead... I rubbed my face, taking a shuddering breath. I wouldn't let myself get that far. My hands shook as I paused before the dining room doors, both barely hanging on their hinges. I couldn't tell if the damage was from his lashing out after Reason's arrival the day before my departure, or if someone else had caused it. The giant table was in pieces, the windows smashed, the curtains in shreds. But no blood. There was no blood here. And from the prints and the shards of glass, I studied the trail across the floor. It had been disturbed, but I could make out two sets, large and side by side, leading from where the table had been. As if Tamlin and Lucian had been sitting here as the attack happened and walked out without a fight. If I was right, then they were alive. I traced the steps to the doorway, squatting for a moment to work through the churned up shards, dirt, and blood. They'd been met here by multiple sets of prints and headed toward the garden. Debris crunched from down the hall. I drew my hunting knife and ducked farther into the dining room, scanning for a place to hide, but everything was in pieces. With no other option, I lunged behind the open door. I pressed a hand over my mouth to keep from breathing too loudly and peered through the crack between the door and the wall. Something limped into the room and sniffed. I could see only its back, cloaked in a plain cape, medium height. All it had to do to find me was shut the door. Perhaps if it came far enough into the dining room, I could slip out. But that would require leaving my hiding spot. Perhaps it would just look around and then leave. The figure sniffed again, and my stomach clenched. It could smell me. I dared a better glance at it, hoping to find a weakness, a spot for my knife, if things came down to it. The figure turned slightly toward me. I cried out, and the figure screeched as I shoved away the door.
Alice!
She gaped at me, a hand on her heart, her usual brown dress torn and dirty, her apron gone entirely. Not bloodied, though, nothing save for the slight limp that favored her right ankle as she rushed for me, her tree bark skin bleaching birch white.
You can't be here.
She took in my knife, the bow and quiver.
You were told to stay away.
Is he alive?
Yes, but...
My knees buckled at the onslaught of relief.
And Lucian?
Alive as well.
But tell me what happened. Tell me everything.
I kept an eye on the window, listening to the manor and grounds around us. Not a sound. Alice grasped my arm and pulled me from the room. She didn't speak as we hurried through the empty, too quiet halls, all of them wrecked and bloodied, but no bodies. Either they'd been hauled away or... I didn't let myself consider it as we entered the kitchen. A fire had scorched the giant room, and it was little more than cinders and blackened stone. After sniffing about and listening for any signs of danger, Alice released me.
What are you doing here?
I had to come back. I thought something had gone wrong. I couldn't stay away. I had to help.
He told you not to come back, Alice snapped.
Where is he? Alice covered her face with her long, bony hands and her fingertips grappling into the upper edge of her mask as if trying to tear it from her face.
But the mask remained, and Alice sighed as she lowered her tree bark hands.
She took him, she said,
and my blood went cold.
She took him to her court under the mountain.
Who?
But I already knew the answer.
Amarantha,
Alice whispered, and glanced again around the kitchen as if fearful that speaking her name would summon her.
Why? And who is she? What is she? Please, please, just tell me. Just give me the truth.
Alice shuddered.
You want the truth, girl? Then here it is. She took him for the curse. Because the 7 times 7 years were over, and he hadn't shattered her curse. She summoned all the High Lords to her court this time to make them watch her break him.
What is she? Well, what curse? A curse? A curse she had put on this place. A curse that I had failed to even see.
Amarantha is High Queen of this land. The High Queen of Prithian,
Alice breathed, her eyes wide with some memory of horror.
But the 7 High Lords rule Prithian equally. There's no High Queen.
That's how it used to be. How it's always been. Until 100 years ago when she appeared in these lands as an emissary from Highburn.
Alice grabbed a large satchel that she must have left by the door. It was already half full of what looked like clothes and supplies. As she began sifting through the ruined kitchen, gathering up knives and any food that had survived, I wondered at the information the Soriel had given me of a wicked fairy king who had spent centuries resenting the treaty he'd been forced to sign, and who had sent out his deadliest commanders to infiltrate the other fairy kingdoms and courts to see if they felt as he did, to see if they might consider reclaiming the human lands for themselves. I leaned against one of the soot-stained walls.
She went from court to court, Alice went on, turning an apple over in her hands as she inspected it, deemed it good enough, and stuffed it into the bag. Charming the High Lords with talk of more trade between Highburn and Prithian, more communication, more sharing of assets. The never-fading flower, they called her. And for 50 years she lived here as a courtier bound to no court. Making amends, she claimed, for her own actions and the actions of Highburn during the war.
She fought in the war against mortals? Alice paused her gathering.
Her story is legend among our kind. Legend and nightmare. She was the king of Highburn's most lethal general. She fought on the front lines, slaughtering humans and any high Feyen fairies who dared defend them. But she had a younger sister, Clithia, who fought at her side, as vicious and wretched as she. Until Clithia fell in love with a mortal warrior, Jorian.
Alice loosed a shaking sigh.
Jorian commanded mighty human armies, but Clithia still secretly sought him out, still loved him with an unrelenting madness. She was too blind to realize that Jurian was using her for information about Amarantha's forces. Amarantha suspected, but could not persuade Clithia to leave him, and could not bring herself to kill him, not when it would cause her sister such pain.
Alice clicked her tongue and began opening the cabinets, scanning their ravaged insides.
Amarantha delighted in torture and killing, and yet she loved her sister enough to stay her hand.
What happened? I breathed.
Oh, Jurian betrayed Clithia. After months of stomaching being her lover, he got the information he needed, then tortured and butchered her, crucifying her with ashwood so she couldn't move while he did it. He left the pieces of her for Amarantha to find. They say Amarantha's wrath could have brought down the skies themselves had her king not ordered her to stand down. But she and Jurian had their final confrontation later, and since then, Amarantha has hated humans with a rage you cannot imagine.
Alice found what looked to be a jar of preserves and added it to the satchel.
After the two sides made the treaty, Alice said, now going through the drawers, she butchered her own slaves rather than free them.
I blanched.
But centuries later, the High Lords believed her when she told them that the death of her sister had changed her, especially when she opened trade lines between our two territories. The High Lords never knew that those same ships that brought over Hibernian goods also brought over her own personal forces. The King of Hibern didn't know either. But we all soon learned that, in those 50 years she was here, she had decided she wanted Prithian for her own, to begin amassing power and using our lands as a launching point to one day destroy your world once and for all, with or without her king's blessing. So 49 years ago, she struck. She knew that even with her personal army, she could never conquer the 7 High Lords by numbers or power alone. But she was also cunning and cruel, and she waited until they absolutely trusted her, until they gathered at a ball in her honor. And that night she slipped a potion stolen from the King of Hibern's unholy spellbook into their wine. Once they drank, the High Lords were prone, their magic laid bare, and she stole their powers from where they originated inside their bodies, plucked them out as if she were taking an apple from its branch, leaving them with only the basest elements of their magic. Your Tamlin, what you saw of him here was a shade of what he used to be, the power that he used to command. And with the High Lord's power so greatly decreased, Amarantha wrested control of Prithian from them in a matter of days. For 49 years we have been her slaves. For 49 years she has been biding her time, waiting for the right moment to break the treaty and take your lands, and all human territories beyond it.
I wished there were a stool, a bench, a chair for me to slump into. Alice slammed shut the final drawer and limped for the pantry.
Now they call her the Deceiver, she who trapped the 7 High Lords and built her palace beneath the sacred mountain in the heart of our land.
Alice paused before the pantry door and covered her face again, taking a few steadying breaths. The sacred mountain, that bald, monstrous peak I'd spotted in the mural in the library all those months ago. But the sickness in the lands. Tamlin said that the blight took their power.
She is the sickness in these lands, Alice snapped, lowering her hands and entering the pantry. There is no blight but her. The borders were collapsing because she laid them to rubble. She found it amusing to send her creatures to attack our lands, to test whatever strength Tamlin had left.
If the blight was Amarantha, then the threat to the human realm. She was the threat to the human realm. Alice emerged from the pantry, her arms full of various root vegetables.
You could have been the one to stop her.
Her eyes were hard upon me, and she bared her teeth. They were alarmingly sharp. She shoved the turnips and beets into the bag.
You could have been the one to free him and his power, had you not been so blind to your own heart. Humans, she spat.
I lifted my hands, exposing my palms to her.
I didn't know.
You couldn't know, Alice said bitterly, her laugh harsh as she entered the pantry again. It was part of Tamlin's curse.
My head swam, and I pressed myself further against the wall.
What was?
I fought the rising hitch in my voice.
What was his curse? What did she do to him?
Alice yanked remaining spice jars off the pantry shelf. Tamlin and Amarantha knew each other before. His family had long been tied to Highburn. During the war, the Spring Court allied with Highburn to keep the humans enslaved. So his father, who was a fickle and vicious lord, was very close to the King of Highburn, to Amarantha. Tamlin, as a child, often accompanied him on trips to Highburn, and he met Amarantha in the process.
Tamlin had once said to me that he would fight to protect someone's freedom, that he would never allow slavery. Had it been solely because of shame for his own legacy, or because he'd come to somehow know what it was to be enslaved?
Amarantha eventually grew to desire Tamlin, to lust for him with her entire wicked heart. But he'd heard stories from others about the war and knew what Amarantha and his father and the Highburn King had done to fairies and humans alike. What she did to Jurian as punishment for her sister's death. He was wary of her when she came here, despite her attempts to lure him into her bed, and kept his distance right until she stole his powers. Lucian was sent to her as Tamlin's emissary to try to treat for peace between them.
Bile rose in my throat.
She refused, and Lucian told her to go back to the shithole she'd crawled out of. She took his eye as punishment, carved it out with her own fingernail, then scarred his face. She sent him back so bloody that Tamlin, the High Lord, vomited when he saw his friend.
I couldn't let myself imagine what state Lucian had been in then if it had made Tamlin sick. Alice tapped on her mask, the metal pinging beneath her nails.
After that, she hosted a masquerade under the mountain for herself. All the courts were present. A party, she said, to make amends for what she'd done to Lucian, and a masquerade so he didn't have to reveal the horrible scarring on his face. The entire Spring Court was to attend, even the servants, and to wear masks. To honor Tamlin's shape-shifting powers, she said. He was willing to try to end the conflict without slaughter, and he agreed to go, to bring all of us.
I pressed my hands against the stone wall behind me, savoring its coolness, its steadiness. Pausing in the center of the kitchen, Alice set down her satchel, now full of food and supplies.
When all were assembled, she claimed that peace could be had, if Tamlin joined her as her lover and consort. But when she tried to touch him, he refused to let her near, not after what she'd done to Lucian. He said, in front of everyone that night, that he would sooner take a human to his bed, sooner marry a human than ever touch her. She might have let it go had he not then said that her own sister had preferred a human's company to hers, that her own sister had chosen Jurian over her.
I winced, already knowing what Alice would say as she braced her hands on her hips and went on.
You can guess how well that went over with Amarantha. But she told Tamlin that she was in a generous mood, told him she'd give him a chance to break the spell she'd put upon him to steal his power. He spat in her face and she laughed. She said he had 7 times 7 years before she claimed him, before he had to join her under the mountain. If he wanted to break her curse, he need only find a human girl willing to marry him. But not any girl, a human with ice in her heart, with hatred for our kind. A human girl willing to kill a fairy.
The ground rocked beneath me, and I was grateful for the wall I leaned against.
Worse, the fairy she killed had to be one of his men, sent across the wall by him like lambs to slaughter. The girl could only be brought here to be courted if she killed one of his men in an unprovoked attack. Killed him for hatred alone, just as Jurian had done to Clithia, so he could understand her sister's pain. The treaty? That was a lie. There was no provision for that in the treaty. You can kill as many innocent fairies as you want and never suffer the consequences. You just killed Andras, sent out by Tamlin as that day's sacrifice.
Andras was looking for a cure, Tamlin had said. Not for some magical blight, but a cure to save Prithian from Amarantha, a cure for this curse. The wolf, Andras, had just stared at me before I killed him. Let me kill him, so it could begin this chain of events, so that Tamlin might stand a chance of breaking the spell. And if Tamlin had sent Andras across the wall, knowing he might very well die. Oh, Tamlin. Alice stooped to gather up a butter knife, twisted and bent, and carefully straightened out the blade.
It was all a cruel joke, a clever punishment to Amarantha. You humans loathe and fear fairies so much it would be impossible. Impossible for the same girl who slaughtered a fairy in cold blood to then fall in love with one. But the spell on Tamlin could only be broken if she did just that before the 49 years were over. If that girl said to his face that she loved him and meant it with her entire heart. Amarantha knows humans are preoccupied with beauty, and thus bound the masks to all our faces, to his face, so it would be more difficult to find a girl willing to look beyond the mask, beyond his fairy nature and to the soul beneath. Then she bound us so we couldn't say a word about the curse, not a single word. We could hardly tell you a thing about our world, about our fate. He couldn't tell you. None of us properly could. The lies about the blight, that was the best he could do, the best we could all do. But I can tell you now, it means the game is over to her.
She pocketed the knife.
When she first cursed him, Tamlin sent one of his men across the wall every day. To the woods, to farms, all disguised as wolves to make it more likely for one of your kind to want to kill them. If they came back, it was with stories of human girls who ran and screamed and begged, who didn't even lift a hand. When they didn't come back, Tamlin's bond with them as their lord and master told him they'd been killed by others. Human hunters, older women, perhaps. For 2 years he sent them out, day after day, having to pick who crossed the wall. When all but a dozen of them were left, it broke him so badly he stopped, called it all off. And since then, Tamlin has been here, defending his borders as chaos and disorder ruled in the other courts under Amarantha's thumb. The other High Lords fought back, too. 40 years ago, she executed 3 of them and most of their families for banding together against her.
Open rebellion?
What courts?
I straightened, taking a step away from the wall. Perhaps I might find allies among them to help me save Tamlin.
The Day Court, Summer Court, and Winter Court. And no, it didn't even get far enough to be considered an open rebellion. She used the High Lord's powers to bind us to the land. So the rebel lords tried calling for aid from the other Fae territories, using as messengers whatever humans were foolish enough to enter our lands. Most of them young women who worshipped us like gods.
The children of the blessed. They had indeed made it over the wall, but not to be brides. I was too battered by what I'd heard to grieve for them, rage for them.
But Amarantha caught them all before they left these shores, and you can imagine how it ended for those girls. Afterward, once Amarantha also butchered the rebellious High Lords, their successors were too terrified to tempt her wrath again.
And where are they now? Are they allowed to live on their lands like Tamlin was?
No. She keeps them and their entire courts under the mountain, where she can torment them as she pleases. Others, if they swear allegiance, if they grovel and serve her, she allows them a bit more freedom to come and go under the mountain as they will.